Hi, this is Executive Director of the Partnership for Safe Medicine, Shabir Imbersaftar. Thanks for listening to our podcast. Usually we publish short stories about the counterfeit medicine crime environment, but today I want to bring you an interview about a policy initiative that I believe will open the door to criminal activity. As you'll hear from my guest, possibly impede access to medication for American patients. It's longer than a usual episode, but it's a great explainer about the problems prescription drug affordability boards could create. Thanks for listening. Welcome, everyone, to True Crime and Medicine Safety. Today, we're going to talk about one of the externalities, one of the environmental factors that creates danger to patients, and that's prescription drug affordability boards and specific actions that they do to mess with the price. Today, I'm honored to have both my friend and colleague, Jen Laws. And Jen is going to join us and talk about the patient aspect of prescription drug affordability boards and why it may not actually yield the promise that we're hearing. Welcome to the podcast, Jen.
Hey, Shabir.
Jen, will you tell us a little bit about CAN and tell us a little bit about the organization for people who don't know you?
So CAN is short for Community Access National Network, and I happen to be the CEO, and how I got here is a bit of a long story. CAN's been around for about 27 years and doing a lot of federal policy work around issues related to HIV, hepatitis C, and substance use disorder. It's really primarily from the patient perspective. And we don't just deal with legislation and regulatory issues. We also talk with manufacturers and program administrators in different states. Like, really, the thing that we know in this space is that we succeed in making lives better and having better public health outcomes when we lead from the patient perspective. And part of CAN's job is to really kind of insert that patient perspective, because we've got all these really high-powered, well-funded entities that have a lot to say. And we need to make sure that patients have the most to say, right? Like, the most influence in this space. And that requires some very concerted work. So CAN was kind of instrumental in dealing with the AIDS Drug Assistance Program wait lists when they showed up in 2008, and kind of resolved that through a lot of concerted work there. And the founder of the organization was kind of really instrumental in growing the AIDS Drug Assistance Programs, or ADAPs, as program white, from the $2 million program it started in 1992 to the nearly $2 billion program it is today. And these programs save lives. They're really kind of important in terms of delivering medication to people who need it. So that's the big shoes that the board decided to let me step into. I say that as a let me. I get to, instead of, oh boy, howdy, that's a big shadow. But we've been highly engaged in this PDAB issue because of that big impact that we see or expect to see in ADAPs. So
let me actually ask you that, because you just use an acronym that I'm going to make you define and then explain. What is a PDAB? I've never heard of a PDAB until just very recently.
It's a really sexy term, but it is deceptively sexy. It is prescription drug affordability. And when you hear that as a patient, you get really excited about it. But if you take the patient hat off and you put on the lawyer hat that says, what does that really mean? It gets very, very interesting.
So a prescription drug affordability board is like a state entity that's created to address affordability, I guess, right?
Right. And that's the thing. And it is state. It is very specifically each state that is looking at these things. It is state level. It's not federal level. So there's nobody in Washington, D.C. saying do these things. But there are some interest groups kind of pushing this idea in different states. And there was model legislation built by the National Academy of State Health Policy, and that's, or NASPE for short, and they were funded by a particular entity to kind of push this issue. And now in each state that's considering it, there are groups kind of forming that are also funded by that entity to push this idea of a PDAB, or a prescription drug affordability board. and they're modeled a little bit differently in each state. And that's a really interesting nature about this, is that when you see one PDAB, you see one PDAB, right?
When you've seen one Medicaid program, you've seen one state's Medicaid program.
Right. So what's kind of funny about it is nobody actually knows how to do any of this. Super nutty. Nobody knows how to do any of this, or what it means, or how to implement any of that, go through these processes.
So let me ask this question then. Let's talk specifically about Colorado's, because I know that you've been working a lot on Colorado's. You probably know the most about Colorado's program. What exactly is the Colorado PDAB looking at doing? Like, what's its power? Because we all love the idea of affordable prescription medicine. You know, I spend a lot of time talking about how great the generics market is. You get four of these manufacturers in there and price plunges and you're paying less money than Canadians do for generics. But so I love affordable medicine. What is the Colorado PDAB's, lever to make medicine affordable?
The statute says the tool that they can use is something called an upper payment limit or an upper reimbursement limit. It means that your plan is only allowed, or your pharmacy benefit manager is only allowed to pay up to a certain amount that has to be set by the board on very specific medications that they've considered or deemed unaffordable. And that's really just kind of an interesting approach, because there's nothing that says that the PBM has to kind of translate that back to the plan, and then the plan has to translate that back to the patients. So there's a whole process within that, and the board has to go through and deem a drug unaffordable to begin with, right, before they even start this upper payment limit process. And they've not gotten to instituting an upper payment limit. They've only gotten through a couple of drugs to deem either affordable, to deem unaffordable or not unaffordable. It's kind of weird with the language. It's clunky as all get out. But there's been a couple of questions as to affordable or unaffordable for who, right? Is it for patient? Is it for the system? And I say that with quotes. Is it for providers? Is it for families? Is it for the state as a payer of some kind? So there's not a really good answer as to affordable for who, but the way this board was sold, and it's being sold in every state by legislators talking to their constituents, is really from that patient perspective. So we're trying very hard to make sure that this stays focused on that patient perspective while still giving a nod to some of these system costs they're concerned about.
Yeah, because I think about, affordable to who, and even though you have different kinds of people, right? I was just talking about, for a college student like my child, for whom $50 is an enormous sum of money, and then for a working, middle-aged professional like me, $50 means a lot less. So unaffordable or affordable to whom is a real question. You talked about setting a reimbursement limit. Does that actually echo through the whole supply chain, or is that just the pharmacist who's only affected by this, the pharmacist and their payer?
It only affects the pharmacist and their payer, which is part of the problem with it, right? Because it doesn't change the acquisition costs. And it doesn't change, it does have a dramatic impact on something called 340B, and it's very, very wonky. Essentially, 340B is a rebate program that we use for hospitals and for AIDS drug assistance programs. There are other rebate programs that help fund Medicaid, for example. And that's where the manufacturers kind of pay back based on reducing an acquisition cost after a reimbursement's already been paid. So the value of those rebates are found between the spread between the acquisition cost and the reimbursement rate. So if we're reducing those reimbursement rates by putting a cap on them, then we're taking dollars out of these needy programs, whether it's hospitals, whether it's the AIDS drug assistance program, whether it's the Medicaid program, whether it's your federally qualified health centers. They're all going to see these kind of like negative impacts that are really meant to serve the neediest, sickest patients.
So it's this spread between the pharmacy buys an HIV medicine for $2,000 and you're worried because the amount that they then get reimbursed is part of the funding for services to vulnerable populations. And if it basically ends up being the same, then you basically have just defunded programs for vulnerable populations.
Right, right. Well, and it's not, so that's one of the perverse pieces here. And it's not just a matter of being the same, because I don't know that they're going to be able to come down that far. Some of these medications we see priced at pennies, quite literally a penny, in the 340B program. But let's look at it this way. In Oregon, I know we're going to talk about Colorado, but in Oregon, their AIDS drug assistance program is 70% funded through their 340B rebates. And if you take a big whack at that, even a little whack at that, by reducing the rebates, what you are actively doing at that point in time is taking life-saving medication out of the hands of people living with HIV. You are destabilizing the program.
Yeah. There's also something else I'm struck by here. The idea that these things will actually echo backwards through the supply chain, right? Let's say you buy 30 day, 30 pill, one pill a day HIV medicine for a patient. It comes in one bottle, sealed, costs $2,000, and you decide to make the reimbursement $2,000. So the pharmacy makes no money, which is crazy because it's not supposed to be a nonprofit, but let's or makes less, like $1,900. Let's say you decide that the affordable price should be because you're a PDAB is $1,900. And like, why would the wholesaler lower their price to $1,900? The PDAB doesn't have power over the wholesaler to do that, which means you could be setting a pharmacy up to structurally lose money every time I walk in the door.
Well, and here's the part of the issue there is that the wholesalers don't necessarily operate in the state in which the PDAB exists, right? So there is no market pressure to reduce the acquisition cost. It's just the reimbursement rate. And at the end of the day, when a pharmacy can't fill on a reimbursement rate, they're losing money. They're just going to stop filling it. And that becomes a problem for the drugs that are targeted here.
Wait, so are you actually worried that statewide in Colorado, if an HIV medicine is priced below the wholesale rate, that almost all pharmacies will just stop dispensing it and patients will have to leave the state to get the treatment they need to live?
Yes, yes. And that has nothing to, like, some of the language on this has been really frustrating for me because they're going, okay, maybe the manufacturers won't sell in the state. This has nothing to do with the manufacturers. There's this piece in between that. That's your wholesaler. And your wholesaler operates outside of that. A wholesaler has zero reason to sell a drug below that piece for them just because somebody's reimbursement rate is going to be low.
Yeah. Well, and you also create another weird thing, which is an opportunity for smuggling and arbitrage.
If you ask me about that.
Well, if you were, this isn't even the criminal problem I'm worried about, but if you were to lower the price of the reimbursement to $1,900 for this HIV med, let's use as an example, the one that Colorado PDAB did, which was Genvoya, and it cost $2,000, and they, for some reason, decide to lower their price to $1,900, wouldn't you suddenly have people buying Genvoya in Colorado and taking it to other states for the purpose of making extra money? You would have this weird perverse incentive to basically smuggle medicine out of Colorado, which is bad in every way.
If it could be acquired at that rate, right? Like, that's the thing. If it can be acquired. So, and then there's some other pieces on that where a payer says, hey, if I'm reimbursing this much, much lower, then maybe I'm going to prefer that drug, right? Because I'm still getting the rebate on it as the payer, right? That means that my spread, the thing that I can retain as a payer, as a PBM, is much larger at that point in time. And it's got state enforcement, if we could still get it to happen that way. But the problem with that is that our medications are our medications for a reason, right? Like our doctors, we sat down and said, this is the medication that I need. This one, not another one, not this other one, not pill C or pill B or any of that, but pill A.
Well, I don't think people understand this. I'm gonna posit sort of the straight man example for a second. But when you look at all the different HIV medicines that we have now, you know, the cocktails, as far as I have learned, are specifically responsive to where your virus and how it operates in that moment in your body. And you just can't exchange them one for the other because your insurance company gets a better rebate. Like, that's specifically chosen for you. So much so that one of the problems that I've learned from talking to advocates is that if you get a subtherapeutic HIV med, your body could develop an immunity to that treatment and you might have to shift treatment. So we have to, the idea of non-medically switching a patient to another treatment both doesn't work and is super dangerous to their long-term health from what I've learned.
Right. And even if, like, you can build up, and we call that process resistance, and it's where the virus stops responding to that medication. And it's not just an HIV, certainly in HIV, that's where my focus is. But we see that kind of happen in other health conditions as well. So it, like, there's a reason we get the medications that we get, right? That our provider says, hey, this is the medication that you need. And this kind of gives a perverse incentive to push something else, right? Like, that's how you lose people to care. And that's something that's really important for us in public health programs around HIV, is making sure people stay in care in order to achieve viral suppression, which means that you can't transmit HIV. That's a big goal, right? Like, that is our big star goal with each individual person, right? But if you're running into problems because of your pharmacy not being able to make medication, or if your payer saying no, you should try something else, and all of these barriers, how much are you really going to want to fight that? How much do you have time to fight that as somebody who has to work? As somebody who might be struggling with housing insecurity, like, how much do you as an individual patient have the power to fight those institutional pieces, especially when the state is putting their thumb on it through a prescription drug affordability for it?
This is so frustrating to me. I really, like, we live in an era, and I've lived through the era where we did not have medication to fight HIV. And I lived through the era where we all went to funerals. And I am so angry when we have medication that can actually let you live a normal life, make you untransmittable and undetectable, and it is not, and someone gets in the way who's not your doctor, between the doctor and the patient and the medicine you're supposed to get. Like, there's crazy to me that there are, that a company that, you know, like an insurance company that has decided they would like to make more money off the medicine they dispense you, changes the choice that your doctor and you made for your health. That's just wrong. I just think
it is. It is. And it's really kind of frustrating. So what we did in Colorado is we had a bunch of experts come and explain this. And because one of the drugs that they had initially selected was Genvoya, which is an antiretroviral used to treat HIV. And we were able to kind of explain, this is why this isn't actually an affordability issue. We have all of these safety nets here. We have, patient assistance programs from the manufacturers. There's giving these coupons. And what's really kind of cool about the coupon model there, and I say kind of cool because it's kind of messed up, is that PBMs are already under reimbursing pharmacies. They're already taking some kind of loss, especially if they're trying to steer patients in a particular direction. But those manufacturer patient assistance programs that have an actual dollar amount that get assigned to that pharmacy and paid on the back end. So in a really kind of weird way, manufacturers are also supporting pharmacies through this piece, right? And I don't know how that might play under a upper reimbursement limit, but this thing about under reimbursement is something that kind of concerns me because of some of the history that we've got in HIV with counterfeit medications. And you kind of brought something up, and I'd like to hear a bit more about that interplay of things, if you don't mind.
Sure. So it's funny that they chose Genvoya, because we have been following what I believe will be the largest counterfeit case that I will ever touch in my career, which is, we call it the Safe Chain case, but that's just one of 150 defendants in this enormous civil litigation that Gilead brought against an enormous number of people who were diverting and counterfeiting their medication. They were buying back from patients, not Safe Chain specifically, but in this group, 150 people would buy back from patients a bottle of medicine or an empty bottle, and then they would just throw random crap in it, whatever they thought that, you know, would make the bottle weigh about the same. And then they would seal up the bottle and they would sell it. And they did it with Genvoya. They had bottles of Genvoya that did not have Genvoya medicine in them that they sold. And here's the trickiest part. It wasn't like they were selling on a street corner. These are very sophisticated people. They had state-issued wholesale pharmaceutical distribution licenses. And so they were selling it to pharmacies. And so patients got the wrong medicine. And there's photos in the legal complaint and tons of counterfeit Genvoya. And here's the issue. You got to ask yourself, like, I will tell you from working in this field for 10 years, pharmacists never cut corners on the medication they buy. They're always really careful. They don't want to lose money. So they're looking for the cheapest price, but they're not going to go buying something sketchy that makes their spidey sense tingle.
Well, not intentionally, at least, right?
No.
They're going to do everything they can to do this the right way to take care of the person in front of them. Right?
Yeah. And they have a real visceral reaction because, you know, they're the one that hands the patient the medicine and they're the first one that will get blamed. And they've got a real health commitment. To become a pharmacist these days, you must have a health commitment because it's hard. And, you know, it's kind of a rough profession to work in right now. And these criminals were selling Genvoya, and you got to ask yourself, well, who was buying and why were they looking for bargains? Because you can get Genvoya from one of the big three wholesalers that, you know, has a deal with Gilead. And the answer is, you know, they were being pressured because it turns out that pharmacy benefit managers were reimbursing pharmacies for Genvoya below cost of acquisition. So if it costs $2,000 a month, they were giving the pharmacy $1,900 a month. And they basically didn't care that they were going to have to lose $100 every time that patient came in the door every month. And they were like, that's just not our problem. And so pharmacists reasonably were out there saying, okay, where can I legally and safely acquire this from somewhere else? And so in my mind, by under reimbursing below the cost of acquisition, the PBMs were creating an opportunity for criminals to play in the supply chain. Like, their market would not have existed if the PBMs hadn't done this. The PBMs were driving the creation of demand for criminal activity.
Well, so we've got this thing, right? Like, you're looking at this PBM under reimbursement issue. It's not like it's not there. And now we've got these PDABs pushing to reduce reimbursements even further. Like, does that actively make room for more criminal enterprise?
Yes. Basically, I've come to the conclusion that anything that causes a pharmacy to lose money when they dispense because they have to buy at a higher price than they get reimbursed is going to drive criminal activity. And whether it's a PBM doing it or health insurance company or a state prescription drug affordability board, if you are causing the pharmacy to have to lose money, you are basically putting them in a position of becoming an attractive target for counterfeiters. Now, the counterfeiters are going to have to bring all of their savviness to the thing because pharmacists aren't just going to fall for anything. But, you know, criminals, when they have a lot of time and there's a lot of money to be made, can get very good at convincing and doing, you know, building perfect fakes that look perfect in every way and so forth.
Well, and like you said, they've already done it, right? This particular medication that I'm concerned about. But like, wow, that's nuts. And so do you feel like states kind of have a, like legislators that are looking at this have any kind of handle on that?
Well, I mean, this is one of the problems of doing healthcare policy in the U.S. is it's as complicated as all heck. And so I view, you know, setting an upper payment limit as probably being the hammer solution, right? Complex systems don't get fixed without complex solutions. And I'm just going to set one upper payment limit in one part of the supply chain as a simple hammer-like solution. It's not a, it doesn't befit it, and it's going to create unintended consequences. We already know. Like I can tell you from watching PBMs, I know exactly what happens if you set the upper payment limit for a Genvoya or one that Colorado did do for Enbrel below the cost of buying it from the wholesaler. If you do that, you've basically created a huge opportunity for criminals in the supply chain. We know it from PBMs, and it's the same thing's going to happen from PDAPs.
Yeah, I mean, the Hospital Association of Colorado came out against that declaration, and they've been fairly consistent. It's not just Enbrel, but certainly because that's the drug that's making some kind of headway in that. The Hospital Association in Colorado said, listen, this is going to have an impact on patient access to care. Like, we can go and explain all the details between 340B and clearly acquisition concerns and safety concerns. But it's not this reimbursement process, this one hammer, as you said, it's just not going to be the way to go about it. I don't really have a handle on what kind of reimbursement limit they would set.
Yeah.
So there's that too.
I think I know about the Colorado and the Oregon PDAB, but there's other PDAB legislation and PDABs around the country. You know, I know that you are only one gen. You're not, although you do seem to sometimes seem like you're five gens, the amount of like output you have in terms of writing and appearing and organizing. How many other states do you worry about as the last thing you do before you put your head on a pillow?
Oh, it is indeed the last thing I do these days before I put my head on a pillow. It's also the first thing I wake up to, which is its whole thing. But I'm really grateful for CAN's consultants, the patients that we engage. So part of our background real quick, and I promise I will answer the state questions. And everybody who works for CAN, everybody that we contract with, is either somebody living with HIV or has had HIV have a major impact in their life. We are patient driven in the sense that we aren't going around and hiring the wonkiest wonk, right? Like we grow up patients into this space to make sure that that voice is the first voice every single time, myself included, right? Mm-hmm. So the states, we've got Oregon, Washington, Colorado is going to continue to be an issue, Minnesota, Maryland has a PDAB. Virginia is looking to pass one. There's a bill that would put that in front of the governor probably sometime in the next couple of weeks to see if he vetoes it again or not. Michigan technically still has one that could be calendared at any time, but it's not going to. Illinois is my biggest source of heartburn right now because they may or may not hear the bill on issue on Tuesday, and they're dealing with some navigation on there. So Oregon's really important to me right now. They've got a couple of extra steps there, but they're finally starting to understand that they need to engage community. So they're going to start doing listening sessions.
Yeah,
that was one of the things we really had to push in Colorado, is listen to patients, right? This is about patients, and listen to patients, right? That's where you've got to start and end everything in this. And whether it's an issue of safety, as PSM is concerned, or it's an issue of program continuity and access to care, as I'm concerned, patients are going to tell you what they're seeing, what they're feeling, where things are real or not real based on their experiences, not what's put on a sheet of paper, right? It's not a rhetorical argument. It's a real life experience.
Yeah. I should probably mark that we are recording this on Thursday, March 7th. So if you're listening to this and it is much later in the year, some of the things we've said may have turned out to be different. Let me ask this question. If you're a person living with HIV and you've heard things that concern you about your access and you happen to live in a state either that you, Jen, you've just mentioned or that you've heard is creating a PDAB, how would a patient get involved in being able to speak up at one of these meetings, which I understand happened on Zoom, so you don't even often have to travel?
Yeah, most of them are happening on Zoom. As a matter of access, it was one of the cool things that came out of COVID was that for public meetings, doing this through Zoom gave near the public an opportunity to participate. And that's really kind of important. So in states that already have PDABs, they have regular meetings. In each of the states, PDABs have a website, but TIN also has a monitoring page on her website. And that's TICANN.org. And you can, there's a little splash spot and the app's clickable and it'll show you the letters. It'll give you a link that we've written, the letters that we have written, and our engagement, but also a link to that state's actual PDAP page. Now, for states that haven't actively passed legislation, your state session is time to engage, right? Like, go talk to your legislators, go identify who's sponsoring this, what committee it's in, and talk about what's important to you. Talk about your experiences. We will not get to a solution in terms of patient access and affordability just because a PDAB or some kind of secretive billionaire group has decided to write this disclaimer in something, right? It's got to come comprehensive. It's got to come with everybody at the table, and it's got to start from a patient perspective every single time. So that is the piece.
And if there's someone who is not quite up to looking up legislation and seeing who's involved, they can just, and we'll put CAN's address in the description of this podcast. They can just reach out to you and volunteer themselves as a future champion or a future speaker. Yeah.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And that's, we try to make this easy in terms of stuff. So we've put up our model letters. There's all the contact information and it's all in one spot. Our systems are made better from patient engagement. It's just how it is.
So if you are a pharmacist who has a concern about this, you can reach out to PSM. You can go to our website at safemedicines.org, or you can email us at editors@safemedicines.org. But I will tell you, I work with a lot of the state pharmacy associations who have expressed concerns about this, both in Colorado and in Oregon. I've seen the state pharmacy association speak up for their pharmacists and say, if you set an upper payment limit that causes us to lose money, it's going to do weird things that you don't want to patient care. I'll probably connect you with them, but I'm happy to take your input, or you can contact them straight away and it'll be no skin off my nose. Jen, thank you. This has been a great conversation, and I love that we get to actually do a podcast together. Hopefully it's not the last.
Oh, absolutely, man. I love hanging out with you. Well, yeah, fine.
And if you want to see more episodes of our podcast, we are now everywhere. Apple Podcasts, Spotify Podcasts, on Amazon, and of course on Podbean. You can go to our website. There's a little window to our podcast on our homepage at www.safemedicines.org. Thank you, Jen, and thank you everybody for listening.